We usually sit down here with a stack of material that feels like, honestly, like a mountain.
Oh, yeah. Like physically heavy stacks of paper.
Right. We're talking hundreds of pages, complex research papers, thick volumes of historical analysis. It feels like standing at the base of a massive skyscraper, just, preparing to explore every single floor.
And cataloging every room along the way. It takes hours just to get through the introduction sometimes.
Exactly. But today, the source we are looking at is completely different. I mean, radically different. In fact, if you just glanced at it while scrolling through your phone, you'd probably dismiss it as generic clickbait.
Which is so easy to do.
Yeah.
We see this kind of stuff every day.
We really do, because today we are looking at a single isolated sentence, just 9 words, the title of a piece, and the title is Money Habits That Separate the Rich from the Poor.
It sounds incredibly mundane on the surface, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does.
It's the kind of phrase plastered across 1,000 airport bookstore covers, or, embedded in the thumbnail of some flashy productivity video on YouTube.
Right, with a guy pointing at the sports car or something.
Exactly. And because it's so ubiquitous, our brains tend to just filter it out as background noise. We don't stop to interrogate the architecture of a sentence like that.
But when you actually force yourself to stop and stare at those 9 words, you realize something kind of crazy. You don't even need the rest of the book or the article to understand the worldview being sold to you.
No, you really don't.
The blueprint of the author's entire philosophy is etched right into the title. So, welcome to today's deep dive. I'm thrilled you're joining us because while our source material today is incredibly brief, I mean, literally a sentence, it presents a massive opportunity.
A huge opportunity. Because we aren't going to look at a list of specific financial tips today.
Right. We don't have them, and honestly, we don't need them. What we are going to do is deconstruct the underlying assumptions we make about wealth, success, and human agency just by examining the linguistic scaffolding of this one specific phrase.
Because sometimes a title reveals the entire philosophical framework of its author. A title like this isn't an accident.
No, definitely not.
In the world of nonfiction, a title is a carefully calibrated piece of linguistic machinery. The author chooses each word to evoke a very specific psychological reaction.
To establish an undisputed premise right out of the gate.
Exactly, and to frame the boundaries of the conversation before the reader even reaches the first paragraph.
Yeah.
When we slow down and really examine the nouns, the verbs, and the implicit causality woven into those 9 words, we start to see the hidden mechanics.
The hidden mechanics of how modern culture processes the concepts of success and failure. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the very first conceptual block in this foundation.
The very first word, really. Well, the second word.
Right. The text explicitly uses the phrase money habits to define its core subject matter. It doesn't say money strategies, it
Right.
doesn't say financial systems, and it certainly doesn't say socioeconomic circumstances. It zeroes in on habits.
What's fascinating here is how that single word, just habits, fundamentally shifts the entire landscape of the conversation.
How so?
Well, when we talk about wealth in an academic or societal sense, we're usually looking at an incredibly complex web of intersecting factors.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge mess of variables.
Right, we're talking about macroeconomic cycles, generational inheritances, the geographical luck of where you happen to be born.
Systemic economic conditions, institutional access, all of that.
All of that.
Yeah.
But by framing wealth exclusively through the lens of habits, the text intentionally sweeps all of that complexity right off the table.
It just ignores it.
Completely. It takes the camera, pans completely away from the global economy, and zooms in entirely on the individual's daily, repeated behavioral patterns.
So it places the locus of control entirely within the individual.
It does. It shifts the narrative from a macro-level structural discussion to a micro-level behavioral one. And, there's a profound psychological utility to that framing.
I can see that. Because if wealth is a byproduct of a habit, it implies that financial success is inherently democratic.
Yes, exactly. A habit isn't something encoded in your DNA. A habit is a behavior that can be learned, practiced, and mastered by absolutely anyone.
Regardless of their starting point in life.
Precisely. The text subtly suggests that your financial destiny is essentially written in your morning routine, in your repetitive daily choices, and your automated behaviors.
But I mean, doesn't that framing completely oversimplify
Oh,
reality?
it massively oversimplifies it.
I get the appeal. It feels good to believe we hold the steering wheel, that we are the masters of our fate. But if we frame wealth purely as a behavioral habit, we're ignoring the friction of the environment.
An environment is huge.
It is. Think about trying to grow a highly sensitive, rare orchid.
I like this.
If you have the habit of watering it perfectly every single day, that's a great habit. But if you're standing in the middle of a temperature-controlled, humidified greenhouse, that habit produces a beautiful flower.
Naturally. The conditions are perfect.
Right. But if you take that exact same habit, I mean the identical behavioral input, and you perform it standing in the middle of the Mojave Desert, the orchid dies.
It doesn't stand a chance.
Right. The environment dictates the outcome just as much as the habit does, so calling it just a habit feels a bit, I don't know, misleading.
Well, you're asking the text to function as an objective sociological treatise, but it's actually functioning as a psychological tool.
Oh, interesting. A tool for the reader.
Yeah. Think about it. If you are standing in the desert and you focus entirely on the fact that you aren't in a greenhouse, the natural human response is cognitive paralysis.
You'd just give up.
Exactly. You won't even bother watering the plant. You'll just let it die immediately because what's the point? The framing of habits isn't necessarily about objective universal truth. It's about utility.
Utility? So it forces an internal locus of control.
Yes. If a reader believes the external system is the primary driver of their financial reality, they become a victim of circumstance. By narrowing the lens exclusively to habits, the author is manufacturing agency.
They are giving the reader the only lever they can actually pull.
Exactly. They're handing them a watering can and saying, focus on this.
So it's a deliberate narrowing of reality, a necessary illusion to get the engine started. Because without the habit, even if you are suddenly transported into the greenhouse, you still don't know how to water the orchid.
That is exactly the point. The internal mechanism has to be built, regardless of the external conditions. We know from behavioral psychology that human brains are incredibly sensitive to cognitive load.
Which means we get overwhelmed easily.
Very easily. The brain consumes a massive amount of energy when it has to make conscious, deliberate decisions, especially about complex or stressful topics like money.
Money is incredibly stressful to think about.
Right. So habits are the brain's way of offloading that cognitive burden. By automating a behavior, the brain pushes it down into the basal ganglia, freeing up the prefrontal cortex for other tasks.
It puts the behavior on autopilot.
Precisely. The text is elevating this neurological trick to the status of a wealth-generating engine. It suggests that if you can automate the right financial behaviors, you remove the emotional friction and decision fatigue that often derail financial stability.
Which means the text is basically arguing that wealth isn't about willpower. Because willpower depletes, but habits don't.
Willpower is a terrible long-term financial strategy.
It really is. You're exhausted by Tuesday.
Right. It requires constant conscious effort. By using the word habits, the text is selling automation. It's selling the idea that you can program yourself like a piece of software.
Once the script is written, it just runs in the background.
Exactly. But as you pointed out with a desert analogy, we can't completely ignore the environmental friction. The amount of cognitive energy required to build a saving habit when your baseline income comfortably covers your living expenses
is drastically lower.
Massively lower than the energy required to build that same habit when you are operating at a financial deficit.
Right. If you are struggling to pay rent, saving $50 is a monumental cognitive effort.
The habit might be the same, but the psychological cost of installing that habit is wildly different based on your starting environment.
And yet the title doesn't care about your starting environment. It just demands the habit.
Yep.
Which brings us to who is actually performing these behaviors.
The characters in our 9 wordplay.
Exactly. This leads into the second major structural pillar of these words. The text sets up a stark, undeniable contrast, the rich and the poor.
It's a striking structural choice. What we are looking at is a strict, uncompromising binary. There's an absolute polarization in the language.
There's absolutely no mention of the middle class.
None.
There's no acknowledgement of the vast spectrum of human financial experience. People who are just getting by, people who are comfortable but not wealthy, people who fluctuate between brackets based on the year, they just don't exist in this title.
They are completely erased.
It's a rigid dichotomy. You are either in one camp or you are in the other.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this kind of binary framing is an incredibly common rhetorical mechanism. Communicators and authors often rely on extremes to make their arguments sharper and, more easily digestible.
Because nuance is messy.
Reality is nuanced. Reality is a spectrum, but nuance doesn't sell, and nuance doesn't motivate. The middle ground is muddy. It's full of intersecting variables and gray areas that confuse the central thesis.
So by mathematically stripping away the middle class, by completely removing the gray area, the text creates a clean, sterile laboratory environment.
It pushes the contrast between the two extremes to the absolute maximum. It forces the reader to look at the starkest possible differences rather than the messy similarities.
It's like cranking the contrast slider on a photograph all the way up until every gray pixel is forced into being either pure black or pure white.
That's a great way to visualize it. And we have to look closely at the specific capitalization and phrasing used here, the rich and the poor.
Right. They are treated almost like proper nouns.
Exactly. These are adjectives that have been transformed into monolithic nouns. The text doesn't say people who currently have a high net worth and people who are currently experiencing systemic poverty.
Here's where it gets really interesting. By categorizing people into these monolithic groups based strictly on their habits, the text implies that financial status is essentially an identity you construct through your daily routines.
Yes, it becomes who you are.
Right. You don't just have wealth or lack wealth. You are the rich or you are the poor. And that core identity is being actively built brick by brick by what you do when you wake up in the morning.
That is the inescapable psychological consequence of tying a binary identity to a behavioral habit. When your habits dictate your category, your financial status ceases to be just a reflection of your bank account.
It becomes a reflection of your character.
It becomes a measure of your internal discipline.
Man, that carries an immense amount of moral weight.
A staggering amount. And this concept is deeply embedded in the modern psychology of wealth. If we accept the premise that our automated behaviors create our financial outcomes, then belonging to the rich is subtly framed as a virtue.
Like you earned it morally, not just financially.
Exactly. It becomes the righteous reward for good, disciplined habits. Conversely, belonging to the poor is subtly framed as a moral failing.
Like it's a consequence of undisciplined or destructive habits.
Right. It flattens the vast, complex socioeconomic reality of human existence into a pure behavioral meritocracy.
A behavioral meritocracy. That's a perfect phrase for what this title is projecting. And for you listening, I want to be clear that we aren't arguing whether this behavioral meritocracy is objectively true or false.
No, we are just exposing the machinery underneath the words.
We are dissecting how the language demands you view yourself. Because a title like this doesn't just sit passively on a page. It aggressively demands that you, the reader, choose a tribe.
It demands self-reflection.
It asks you to audit your own life and say, based on my morning routine, which of these two fundamental identities am I currently performing?
It exploits our innate human tribalism. We are hardwired to want to belong to the successful tribe and avoid the unsuccessful one.
Naturally, nobody wants to be in the failing tribe.
Right. By defining those tribes not by birthright or royal decree, but by accessible daily habits, the text offers an invitation. It basically says the border between these two tribes is open, provided you are willing to adopt the local customs.
The local customs being the habits.
Exactly.
But the tribes aren't just sitting next to each other peacefully. Which brings us to the most kinetic word in the entire sentence. The linchpin.
Sure. The action word.
Right. We have the money habits, which act as the internal tool. We have the rich and the poor, which are the identities. But the word that activates the entire premise, the word that introduces physics into the sentence, is separate.
Money habits that separate the rich from the poor. It's a highly aggressive active verb choice.
It doesn't say habits that describe the rich and the poor. It doesn't say habits that categorize them or distinguish them. It says separate.
The mechanics of separation imply a continuous physical or temporal divergence.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if things are merely different, they can exist side by side. A blue house and a red house are different, but they can sit right next to each other on the same street.
They aren't moving away from each other.
Exactly. Separation means they're being actively pulled apart. It suggests that both groups might actually start in the exact same place.
A shared starting line?
Yes. It implies a shared baseline where everyone has the potential to make choices. But the continuous, unrelenting application of these money habits is the wedge that forces their paths to diverge. Separation isn't a state of being. It's a constant action.
Think about shifting tectonic plates.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Two massive plates of rock start out interlocked. They are physically touching. But underneath the surface, there is a pressure, a force moving in opposite directions.
A very slow, invisible force.
Right. For a long time, the movement is totally imperceptible. If you stood on the fault line on a Tuesday, you wouldn't feel the separation. But that underlying force, which in our text is the daily money habit, keeps pushing.
Day after day.
Year after year. And eventually, a fissure opens, then a gap, and thousands of years later, you have a massive, uncrossable rift valley. The plates are now separated by an ocean. They didn't start that way, but the tiny, continuous daily force ripped them apart.
The tectonic plate analogy is perfect because it highlights the invisible mechanics of the premise. Separation, in the context of this title, isn't a wall that drops down instantly from the sky to divide people.
It's not an overnight event.
No. It is a slow, steady, relentless distancing. The habit is the subterranean pressure.
So what does this all mean? When we look at this idea of separation driven by behavioral habits, what is the core takeaway for how we are supposed to understand financial trajectories?
This raises an important question, perhaps the most critical insight embedded in the subtext. The title relies on an invisible variable that makes the entire premise function, yet it never explicitly mentions it.
What's the variable?
Time.
Time, the friction of time.
Exactly. Separation through habit cannot physically happen overnight. You don't perform a disciplined financial habit on a Monday afternoon and wake up in a different socioeconomic bracket on a Tuesday morning.
That would be nice, but no.
The entire architectural integrity of this 9-word phrase relies heavily on the mathematical reality of compounding time. Habits require time to carve a neural groove in the brain.
And they require compounding time to create a tangible, real-world separation between the two identities the text has established.
Because if you just do something once, it's not a habit.
Right. It's an event. It's an isolated action. It only graduates to the status of a habit through the crucible of repetition.
And therefore, the separation itself is a byproduct of repetition over time. The title is not offering a static snapshot of the world. It is describing a dynamic, chronological process.
It's a moving picture.
Yes. It implies that every single day you perform a specific habit, the rift valley widens slightly. Every day you skip the habit, you drift toward the other side. It creates a paradigm where there is no neutral ground.
Wow. That's an incredibly intense way to live.
It is. It's exhausting.
It makes every micro decision feel massively weighty. If every habit is a slight tectonic shift, then nothing you do is just casual. You are never just treading water. You are always actively being separated in one direction or the other.
Always moving.
You're either actively moving toward the rich or you're actively drifting toward the poor.
It creates a state of perpetual behavioral vigilance, which loops us perfectly back to the psychological burden we discussed at the very beginning.
How so?
If you accept the premise of this title, you accept that you are the sole engineer of that tectonic shift. The systemic factors, the weather, the external economy, the starting environment are completely disregarded in favor of focusing entirely on the internal mechanics of your daily actions.
It's all on you. And for you listening right now, this is the exact reason we do these deep dives. This is why we spend an hour unpacking a phrase that you could read in 2 seconds.
Because the language matters.
Why should you care about how a generic sounding title is framed? Because the language we accept without questioning becomes the invisible scaffolding of our reality. The way we label our routines dictates our fundamental relationship with the world around us.
It shapes our internal monologue.
In this case, it dictates our relationship with money, with our sense of agency, and with how we judge our own successes and failures.
The language we consume quietly shapes the boundaries of what we believe is possible.
Exactly. When you understand that wealth is often framed in our culture not as a static condition and not as a product of complex systemic variables, but as a daily behavioral practice, a habit, it can fundamentally alter how you approach your own resources.
It gives you a new lens.
It allows you to see the tiny, imperceptible tectonic shifts in your own daily life. But crucially, pulling this language apart gives you the critical distance to give yourself some grace.
That is so important, grace.
It really is. It helps you realize that if you are struggling to make a financial habit stick, it might not be a lack of moral discipline. You might just be trying to grow an orchid in the desert.
Which is a nearly impossible task.
Right. Understanding the framing allows you to extract the empowering parts of the message, the idea that you have agency and can change your trajectory, while actively rejecting the toxic parts that demand perfect internal discipline in a deeply imperfect external world.
It creates space for self-compassion to exist alongside self-improvement. You can acknowledge the friction of the desert while still choosing to focus on the watering can in your hand.
We started this deep dive talking about standing in front of a single solitary door in an empty field, realizing you could understand the entire house just by looking at the intricately carved language on the frame.
And we found a lot of architecture in just 9 words.
We have spent this time running our hands over those 9 words. The internal, individualistic focus of habits, the stark, morally weighted binary of rich and poor, and the active, time-dependent divergence of separate.
And by deconstructing them, we've seen how those concepts interlock to create a highly specific, highly motivated worldview.
A worldview that prioritizes agency over circumstance, action over analysis, and individual behavior over systemic reality.
But as we wrap up, I want to pivot away from what the text is explicitly saying and look at what it requires of us internally.
Oh, I like that. Let's hear it.
I think that's the ideal place to land. Because if our external financial outcomes are truly separated by our daily money habits, as this framework strongly asserts, it points to a much deeper layer of human behavior that exists beneath the surface of the wallet or the bank account.
The layers below the habits.
Right. What are the underlying psychological habits that have to shift before we can even attempt to alter our financial ones? We spend so much time talking about the habit of saving, or the habit of investing, or the habit of spending.
Which are all very concrete actions.
But those are just the physical downstream manifestations of upstream mental processes. Before you can change how you allocate your money, do you first have to fundamentally change how you allocate your attention?
Oh, wow. Attention as the primary currency.
Exactly. If you really pull this thread, it suggests that the true habits that separate us aren't financial at all. They are cognitive. The way we process fear, the way we delay gratification, the way we focus our daily attention, those are the foundational habits upon which the money habits are built.
That is an incredible thought to walk away with. Before you audit your wallet, audit your focus. What are you spending your attention on, and how is that cognitive habit widening the rift valley of your own life? Thank you so much for joining us on this exploration today. Keep questioning the everyday language around you, keep looking closely at the simple phrases you were asked to accept, and keep exploring those subtle, shifting tectonic plates in your own life.